welcome to the Fort Worth Court of Appeals. Second Court of Appeals, sorry. We have one case on our 3 o'clock docket. We had one at 1:30 and several other cases that are submitted without argument. And this is Transport Care Services versus Shaw. I'll ask the clerk to call the case. Thank you. Mr. Ferris, are you ready to proceed?
Yes, sir.
Okay, come forward.
May it please the court, the appellants in this case appeal three $50,000 jury awards each of lost earnings. All three awards were based upon complaints that appellant Robert Hogan, one of the three appellants, defamed the appellee Scott Shaw. Appellants challenged the legal and factual sufficiency to support all three awards. And this is the point where I blush and say, yesterday I discovered that somehow the issues disappeared from the front part of our brief, and although they're buried in the body of it, that's an inconvenience to the court, and I'm embarrassed because it was my job, obviously, to do a better job of proofreading it. Now, in the argument, I'm going to sort of, by analogy, dissect an Oreo cookie here. An Oreo cookie has the two black chocolate parts and the stuff in the middle. Actionable conduct and resulting injury are the chocolate pieces, and the white stuff in the middle is causation, which holds it all together. And I'm going to spend most of my argument on the stuff in the middle, unless the court directs me somewhere else. Shaw complains of conduct that involve communications, and the communications have to be complete. That is, somebody's got to say something or write something or email something, and somebody else has got to get it. We've only got real proof of any attempt to communicate, and that is the recorded phone conversation by Robert Shaw received by Eddie Jackson, and it is appended to your briefs. That conversation is not actionable as a defamation because it does not assert a verifiable or purportedly verifiable defaming fact about Shaw. The second attempt or stab by Mr. Shaw at proving some communication was a complaint to the state, which we don't have. The complaint was not produced as evidence in this case. What we have is a letter from the state of Texas to Mr. Shaw saying, we've got someone with Transport Care has raised concerns about whether or not you inappropriately use company credit cards to buy personal things and questioning your relationship with this patient somewhere out in East Texas. The appellant's urge does not amount to the assertion of proof.
What question number 13 and 19 were about? Because I didn't see that you addressed jury question number 13 and 19 in your brief, and it's talking about statements that were allegedly published to Connie Gobert, and I don't know.
No, that one was not awarded, Your Honor. I don't believe there was any damages awarded on that one.
They were answered yes.
I may faint dead away if I'm wrong, but I didn't. Okay, I certainly didn't address that, Your Honor.
Okay, that explains it.
Okay.
I just wondered if that was related to the alleged complaint to the state.
Well, I don't recall that it is, Your Honor, but we still don't. We don't have the complaint. How can you prove a statement in whatever form it is defamatory unless you produce the statement or at least explain what was in it carefully, and to say, well, the state says this was in it or these things were in it, I don't think amounts to the assertion of a verifiable or purportedly verifiable fact. Mr. Shaw also testified that there was some other contacts, and he made reference to some people who had gotten information he was satisfied, and that was defamed him in some way or made it difficult for him to get a job. I would ask the court to compare, and almost all of the testimony in this case that's relevant to these issues is from Mr. Shaw. I would ask the court to compare Mr. Shaw's testimony to an affidavit produced in opposition to a motion for summary judgment. And I think the comparison is valid for this reason. It would not be its surmise and suspicion and speculation throughout, and I don't think it would support it would preclude the trial court from granting summary judgment. And if you had that summary judgment up here on appeal, I think you would not find an affidavit containing all the facts that Mr. Shaw attempted to testify to. I don't think you would find that to be an affidavit that would be proof sufficient to defeat a motion for summary judgment.
What is the location of the affidavit, counsel?
Well, there is no affidavit, Your Honor. I'm just saying if you took his testimony.
Oh, well, I thought you said there was an affidavit. I was going to go find it.
I went from one analogy from an Oreo cookie to another analogy, Your Honor. No, I'm sorry. So that my argument is to the first piece of chocolate cake or cookie, no, we don't have proof of a verifiable or purportedly verifiable fact that was defaming. And finally, on the far side, the remaining piece of chocolate, the damages awards were not based in this case upon a complete calculation because the evidence lacked objective criteria to determine what sum of money would put Shaw in the position he might have otherwise have enjoyed. I'll rely on the cases cited in the brief and the facts cited in reference to that. Now to the white stuff in the middle. Proof of causation has to be more than mere surmise or suspicion. One case that is cited in the appellant's brief on that is the Browning-Ferris versus Reyna case. And to prove causation, you have to, as the court said, you can't do it as the appellee, Mr. Shaw, has attempted to do on this case, stack suspicion upon suspicion or link suspicion to suspicion. Because as the Supreme Court said in Browning-Ferris, suspicion linked to other suspicion produces only more suspicion, which is not the same as some evidence. And that's what we've got in this case. And I would like to discuss the facts as they relate, or rather the record as it relates to this point. The first award was an award to Robert Hogan for $50,000, excuse me, to Mr. Shaw, based upon the fact that the jury found that Robert Hogan had interfered with Shaw's relationship with Northstar EMS. Now, the only proof of anything that Mr. Hogan did, and it was proved, I don't deny it, was proved that he adopted a fictitious persona and spoke with Eddie Jackson, an employee of Northstar. Mr. Jackson was the subordinate to Mr. Shaw. And he got this phone call from someone we were all pretty well satisfied was Mr. Hogan. And as I pointed out, it's appended to your brief, and it doesn't really say very much. The elements of causation of intentional interference with an existing contract include willful and intentional interference and proximate cause. The problem we have in this case, or rather the problem Mr. Shaw has in this case, is first he testified that he quit Northstar because they were going to make him sign a no non-compete agreement. He admitted it. He wasn't going to sign it. That was a deal breaker for him. That was his testimony. Secondly, there's absolutely no proof, no suggestion that Mr. Jackson reported the and he's an underling, please recall, that he reported the call. It was actually two calls from Mr. Hogan to anyone other than the appellee. There's no suggestion that anyone in management or in ownership of Northstar EMS ever heard about this. No one from Northstar EMS or from any other employer or potential employer was called by the plaintiff, Mr. Shaw, to make his case that they either fired him or ran him off or refused to fire him because of something Mr. Hogan said anything Mr. Hogan did. The second award was an award of $50,000 based upon the jury's conclusion that Hogan interfered with Shaw's prospective relationship with other employees. The elements of that are proof that it would have been a contract, an independent tortuous act, conscious desire, or substantial certain knowledge that the conduct would preclude the contract from occurring, and actual harm as a result of the defendant's conduct. And the appellants submit that Mr. Shaw has not proven a single one of these, but I'll look at it on a causation basis. Nobody testified from any of these potential employers. No one testified or could prove or suggest with anything more than suspicion that any of these potential employers ever knew about either Mr. Hogan's phone calls that were received by Eddie Jackson at North Store or about the actual complaint that was filed with the state complaining of Mr. Shaw. So we lack complete causation again there. And finally, the third award was that the jury, and this really duplicates the first award. The jury again awarded $50,000 lost earnings to Mr. Shaw because they concluded that the recording that is appended to the briefs before you was defaming, and it was an award.
Excuse me.
I think Mr. Shaw was headed or trying to head towards getting an award of punitive damages, but what the jury actually awarded in this case is loss of earnings. While the trial attorney for the appellants treated it as a failure to establish a right to exemplary damage by failing to prove compensatory damages, I believe it wasn't just another award of compensatory damages that duplicates the award duplicates the first award. Unfortunately, I don't think that point was preserved with the trial court, and that would be probably a swing for the fences, but that's not available to us. But we don't need it because, again, they don't have proof of causation. There's no proof anyone in management ever heard or was aware of the conversation, and Shaw resigned. He quit to avoid signing a non-commit. The error, preservation of error in this case is based upon either the motion for judgment NOV that was filed by the attorneys who represented the Hogans and their company before the trial court, and later by a motion for new trial filed by another attorney who came in for that purpose. And I feel strongly that this case has to be reversed, but we can't stand here and honestly argue that this is a render case, because at least some of the awards do not appear to my eyes to have been raised in the motion for judgment NOV. Accordingly, we urge the court to remand. And all three of these things are pretty much tied together in a ball of string. So I think that the court should remand the entire case to the trial court for a new trial. I've got a yellow light. Does the court have any questions? Thank you, Honor.
Thank you. Mr. Boyd?
Thank you. May it please the court. As I was preparing for this oral argument, it seemed to me as if we were doing an autopsy for the case. And I'd like to step back for a moment and tell you what this case was like when it was alive. This case is of an EMT, not a public figure, who was fired. He was the first employee of the defendant ambulance company. He was paid half of what he was originally promised when he took the job. He took other jobs during his off time to make ends meet. After he was fired, he did not want to leave Gainesville and began looking for jobs close to home. These companies that hired him or would have hired him would have competed with the defendant's business.
When you say he was fired, who are you saying he was fired by?
The defendants.
Okay.
This is not a wrongful termination case. This is merely about what the vendetta that the defendants went into after they had fired him to keep him from getting another job that might have been a competing job. The defendants then began a program to deny him employment in his profession. They contacted his new employers, one after another, fired complaints with the state licensing authorities. They even accused the local gas station of assisting him to steal from them.
What's the evidence that they filed the complaint with the state agency?
The state agency reported that a complaint had been filed by TSC, the Transportation Care Services, one of the defendants here. The actors for that corporation had to have been either Robert or Julia Hogan, since the corporation can't file it on its own behalf.
But do we know what they said to the state agency? Because if you don't, I mean, then you'd have a this kind of cause of action anytime somebody reported someone to a state agency.
Right. We do know the questions that they ask, and they were about and we went in to proof in the court that both of those items that they mentioned were false. They had to do with the care of a young man, not so young, an old man, out in Midland, I believe it was, but anyway, out in West Texas, where my client was appointed as guardian for this man and attempted to check him out of a nursing home that he was in and wanted to be out of. The report was that he had somehow or another was taking that guy out inappropriately, and of course there's a court order giving him guardianship, so that wasn't inappropriate.
You're assuming that from the question that was asked of him in the letter.
Right. And then the other item they mentioned had to do with credit cards that issued by Transport Care Systems to him for his use, and they had a kind of a wishy-washy sort of system where if he went somewhere to supper and they thought that that was an inappropriate charge, that they would deduct that from his salary, and they did, and they did that for months. And so that, while it is technically true that he charged a card that he shouldn't have, it was also part of the arrangement he had with his employer at the time to do it that way. And they would, if they didn't like the charge, they would deduct it from his pay.
Boyd,
yes,
sir. What other piece of evidence was there as to the state activity other than the letter that's marked as Exhibit 12?
Well, there was a lot of testimony about that from Mr. Shaw.
Okay, well, I'm not talking about oral testimony. Is there any other document?
No, there's no other documentary evidence.
Records from the state obtained or put in evidence, and there wasn't any other evidence in documents about any of these other two. There was an order from the court talking about Mr. Brown being in a drug-induced coma,
right,
and him being entitled to move him. I saw that. And all I saw about this complaint to the state was nothing but this letter. If there's anything else, I'd like to see it.
Yes, Your Honor, we would have too. They would not provide that in discovery. We just simply don't have it.
Thank you, sir.
Was there any evidence that any future or potential employers of Mr. Shaw received any information about these complaints to the state?
Well, they would check with the licensing agency to see if there had been any complaints filed about Mr. Shaw.
Are you assuming that, or did
I'm
you prove that?
That? I'm assuming that. Getting back to the unsupported. I'm reminded that the record shows that there were two employers that withdrew their offer of employment after they had done their investigation and contacted the state agency. Mr. Ferris indicated that unsupported testimony is like an affidavit. There's a lot wrong with that. For one thing, an affidavit does not stand in front of a jury, does not go through cross-examination, does not answer questions, does not present his persona for viewing by the jury to determine how honest he is. There was no contradiction of his testimony on virtually all the points that they raise, where they say the only evidence is unsupported testimony. Well, testimony is evidence, and uncontradicted evidence it's true that the fact finder could disbelieve everything that they hear from a particular witness, but in this case they chose not to. They chose to believe a good portion of what they heard. And they didn't go for us on every question, but they went for us on many of them. And that is why our law is reluctant to overrule the fact finders in their fact finding, because you don't get the opportunity to see the witnesses. You don't get the opportunity to judge their credibility. It is not an affidavit that's presented to you. It is a hearing in front of a judge, in front of a jury, with cross-examination, where the fact finders have found the facts. They indicate that we introduced no evidence on damages. I believe if you'll examine the record and the citations that we gave you in the brief, you will notice that we gave evidence of what he was making before, the jobs he was offered after he was fired at by the defendants, and the kind of work that he was able to get after they essentially blackballed him from being able to do EMT work. From those numbers, there is plenty of evidence for them to for the jury to have made reasonable judgments, and they did.
So is there a dispute about whether he was fired or resigned?
All right, I'll talk about that. He was clearly fired by the defendants, but what you're interested in, I think, is the North Star circumstance. In North Star, 4 days before this call that Mr. Hogan made under an assumed name, pretending to be the chief of EMTs in Cook County, where he later called back and admitted, well, I'm not the chief, I'm just one of the employees. Well, that wasn't true either. He had no, so we called that gentleman who he had purported to be and had him testify that he had not authorized Hogan to make these statements or anybody to make these statements, and that Hogan had never been his employee. Any rate, getting back to 4 days before that call, Mr. Shaw was given a substantial raise. Shortly after that call, they asked him to sign a non-compete agreement that no one else in the company was asked to sign. And there were other, there was other evidence of their difference in the way that he was treated after that call. And they simply said, sign this or resign, and so he resigned. But he resigned under pressure. He resigned as a result of this phone call and the pressure that was put on him.
The evidence that the non-compete was actually a pretext, because that's what your position is
right,
that it was a pretext. What is your evidence, since you had the burden of proof? What is your evidence that this non-compete, when we know from his history that Mr. Shaw did work for more than one company at a time? What's wrong with an employer saying you can't do that? You have to sign this non-compete. How do we know this is a pretext? What was your evidence?
Okay. Well, for one thing, the non-compete didn't address that issue. It addressed the issue of his not being able to go to work for anyone else after he left their employment, either in Moody, Texas, or in the Dallas area. And and almost all of this evidence is from testimony by the plaintiff.
Okay, and while I understand your argument very well about judging the credibility of the witnesses, when it comes down to a legal issue of your client getting on there and saying, I think that this happened because of the phone call, I mean, what is the evidence that Mr. Jackson told the owners about the phone call, or that he, that the owners did something as a result of the phone call, or that he was, they made him, you know, sign the non-compete or resign as a result of the phone call? Is it just not supposition?
No, it's the difference in the treatment he got. He was the honored employee one day, and next day he was not. He was treated very differently by the administration at the place he worked, and eventually required to resign.
Is there any evidence that this phone call, another question is, what is it in the phone call that was a statement of fact and not opinion? Tell me, point directly for me to what was stated in the phone call that's not just an opinion, but it's a statement of fact.
He's the kind of opinion that's not allowed, First Amendment guarantees, is exactly the sort that was given here. What he said was, I know things that would make him unemployable by you, but I can't tell you because of HIPAA. I have secret knowledge of facts, but I can't tell you because of HIPAA. So this is, was obviously an intention to harm his employment. It is slander per se.
Mr. Boyd, the phone call transcript that's attached as Exhibit C to the appellant's brief is initiated according to what's there about a question being whether North Star EMS is about to expand into Cook County or Gainesville. It wasn't a call initially about Mr. Shaw.
Well, I think it actually was, because Mr. Shaw had been working for companies that began expanding into Cook County, and he had obviously, Hogan had heard that Shaw was working for North Star now, and so he's calling them to see if they're going to expand.
Well, the gentleman who he claimed, Mr. Hogan claimed to be, was Mr. Harbin, and he was called as a witness, you mentioned a moment ago, and part of his testimony was that he understood by reputation that there was some bad reputation on the part of Mr. Shaw. You recall that testimony?
Yes.
What evidence is there that refutes the truth of these statements about Mr. Shaw is not to be trusted, or is a person that you should check into his background further, things of that kind? Was there evidence as to whether or not those statements were truthful?
If I'm not sure how you get around the fact that an attempt like that to harm his employment relationship is slander per se.
Well, that's not what I'm asking you. What I'm asking is, did somebody say to Mr. Shaw, is there anything about your reputation that is bad? And then he explained, no, there is not. Or explained, yes, there are some things that are rumors that are said. I'm just looking at what question and answer was there. I mean, it's a common thing you can ask a witness.
Right.
Do you know the reputation of Mr. Shaw? Yes. And how do you know that reputation? And then explain. And then the question is, what is that reputation? And the answer can be, it's good or it's bad.
Right.
I just wondered if there was any exchange like that. I read good parts of this record, but I haven't read the whole trial. And I'm just wondering what I'll find when I get to reading the whole trial about that kind of thing.
Well, I think there were some of those, but I don't think they were directly on point. at North Star. May it please the court, may I have another 2 minutes?
I'm asking questions, so sure. I feel like.
Yes.
The appellant has suggested that the jury had insufficient evidence on the issue of intention of actual malice on the defendant's part. The evidence is plentiful on that issue. The repeated calls to employers, filings with state agencies in one instance. But there's one instance that's yet to be brought to the court's attention in any brief. I speak of evidence of witness tampering shown on page 153 of the record. Of course, the continuation of testimony on this point on the transcript pages 160 through 165 regarding questions asked by the trial judge was outside the presence of the jury. But the jury saw that Mr. Hogan did not testify, that he did not contradict any of the things that Mr. Shaw had to say, and that he tried to keep the plaintiff's witnesses who were under subpoena from testifying. I believe it shows actual malice. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Ferris, is there a rebuttal?
Briefly, Your Honor. Mr. Shaw testified without explanation or cross-examination that Robert Hogan was the one who filed the complaint with the state. Perhaps that was hearsay, we don't know. No one challenged him on it, and that, I believe, is the kind of uncontested fact that we can say, well, yeah, we'll accept that, that it was Robert Shaw who filed the complaint. Robert Hogan that filed the complaint. Mr. Shaw also testified that Hogan had spoken with Donna Miller, who was management or an employer, I think management, and that this appears in volume 4, page 35 of the record, that he knew that Hogan had spoken with her, and then he asks you to assume or to validate his suspicion that it was something that Hogan said to Miller that cost him his job. That's the sort of, and by the way, it's true that Hogan never addressed that. Hogan didn't testify. The appellants put no testimony on in this case. They just rested after the plaintiff rested. That's not the sort of uncontested fact that I believe you can assume is true, because it gets back to this surmise and suspicion and speculation, and it's not the plaintiff still has to prove his case. Plaintiff can't get up and say, I think XYZ happened, sit down and rest and win if the defendant doesn't put on any evidence. And that's what this sort of amounts to. One other thing that was said in argument. After I read the appellee's brief, I went and checked the record out. And if I can't see what's in my brief, I don't know why you would believe what I tell you was in the record. But on page, regarding the statement that no one else at North Star was required to sign a non-compete, I could find no evidence of that in the record. At volume 4, page 41, I found where Mr. Shaw testified that it was not standard as far as operations directors went to require a non-compete. But given his history and given what we've just heard, that it was a common knowledge that there were other people moving into this market and he was working for them, I think it's the inference is easily believable that they had good reason to think they needed a non-compete from Mr. Shaw, the folks at North Star. And finally, again, no potential employers testified, and there's nothing by way of documents or supervisory personnel, anyone that would suggest any reason why other people didn't hire Mr. Shaw, at least not on the basis of anything that any of the appellants may have done. Now, there's plenty in the record about other employers, prior employees of Mr. Shaw, and it would not be defaming him to say they were less than happy with his performance. That's all I have, unless the court has any questions.
Mr. Ferris, I'm curious. How would you address the fact in this case that Mr. Shaw was the principal witness testifying, and then the jury made findings based upon what the jury felt was acceptable evidence and testimony? And since we all know the jury can believe all of what any witness says, or some of it or none of it, and So if the only person testifying about some of these things, and I'm not talking about applying the law as to what are words that are defamatory, either per sod or whatever they are. I'm just only not talking about the law. I mean, just in terms of the facts, if the testimony that was heard was principally Mr. Shaw and the jury went along with him, then we're looking at a jury finding made by jurors who were looking at the witness and made a factual determination. How do we get around that in terms of your position that this was just Mr. Shaw and speculation?
Well, because, well, Judge, I'm an appellate lawyer. You know, we show up after the battle was over and shoot the wounded.
I understand. I'm not faulting anyone's trial so technique or anything.
I wasn't there, Your Honor. I can think that perhaps they didn't like Mr. Hogan. I find him pleasant enough, but only, I guess, because he pays my bills. But there is still a standard, and we know there is, that obviously where the, like, given again the example, Mr. Shaw testified, Robert Hogan is the one who sent that, made that complaint with the state. The jury believed it, and they may have believed it in part because it wasn't refuted by Hogan and because they found Shaw was credible on that. But they can't find credible, they can't find stuff to be credible and make that binding on this court if it doesn't meet the legal standards that you address every day up here, and that's how I do it. The only other response I've got, Your Honor, is Mr. Shaw had these silver-tongued devils representing.
Well, that's something every party and litigant could hope for, Mr. Ferris.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you. Thank you all for coming here today and making your presentation. Your case is submitted, and you're excused, and we'll stand adjourned for the day.